May the Force be with us. The first evidence of the use of hypnosis as a reliable operational tool of the cryptocracy, according to John Marx, can be found in the work of Morse Allen in 1954. Of course, hypnosis itself had been used by humans and fakirs to manipulate and control people for centuries. Marx explains that Allen's work came at the height of the Project Artichoke explorations, in which spooks attempted to use hypnosis to program an assassin. CIA documents also reveal that in 1959, John Gittinger recommended the use of hypnosis in operational experiments. Of course, our latest evidence shows that the Navy intelligence had been using mind control in the 1940s at least. The CIA files contain a translation of a Soviet research project entitled Unperceived Manifestations of Mental Processes in Deep Hypnosis, which described the success of their psychoscientists. We succeeded in programming not only the subject of dreams, I would like to visit Africa in my dream, quotations, but to program color perception, let me dream in blue, as well as inducing a specific mood after sleeping. The CIA's active interest in the use of post-hypnotic suggestions is further evidence in their October 1966 confidential technical report, Hypnosis in Intelligence. The report states, quote, "Most of the proposed uses of hypnosis in intelligence work, particularly the defensive applications, involve post-hypnotic suggestions. They discovered that, conservatively, a post-hypnotic suggestion is believed to remain effective for several months and beyond this for years, if periodically reinforced." The CIA paid equal attention to self-hypnosis and auto-suggestion. Of course, one aspect, anything found in the CIA document obtained under the Freedom of Information Act. The emphasis on these relatively harmless forms of hypnosis is probably just part of the cover story planted in the files for persistent researchers to discover. We know from the scientific literature that hypnosis can be used to cause spontaneous death through manipulation of the histamines in the body, control of respiration, induction of severe asthmatic attacks, and the control of other involuntary functions by post-hypnotic suggestion. Of course, any technology can be applied to harm a person as well as help a person. Whatever can kill can also cure. In the 1970s, John Grinder stood on the side stage and said, "There is no such thing as hypnosis." Richard Bandler stood on the side up of the stage and said, "Everything is hypnosis." Grinder and Bandler, the creators of neurolinguistic programming, were both correct in what they said. Hypnosis is a normal, everyday process. We all go in and out of it and trance several times every day. It's so ordinary, so much a normal part of life, it doesn't seem to deserve to be isolated from the rest of our everyday mental processes and given a special name. Hypnosis is not sleep, but hypnosis has something in common with sleep. In both states, one accesses one unconscious or subconscious mind. If hypnosis and NLP is anything, it is the art of addressing the unconscious mind. Go along with me for just a minute. Remember a time when you wore a costume. Could have been to a Halloween party or some costume party or in a play. See yourself in that costume. Now, what would it do, and what would you do if you were going to wear the costume today? How would you improve it? See yourself in the new improved costume. If you're really letting my words guide you, you are looking into your mind's eye, imagining what you must have looked like in the past in some particular costume. Maybe you remember a photograph of yourself in the costume, and you were looking at it, and that was in your mind's eye. At first, you were accessing the remember part of the visual filming system, the filing system. Then, when you decided you'd improve it for today, you were accessing a different part of your mind's eye, where you keep the creative visual department. In any event, What you are doing is the same thing people have done since the days of Nathan Mesmer, the inventor of mesmerism, or way back in the days of the prehistoric shamans. You are enjoying the use of your trance state. You are dissociated from your surroundings momentarily and looking within. Seeing with your mind's eye, you had put yourself into a hypnotic trance. You might as well just call it creative visualization. It's a very useful tool when known to actors and athletes. Go along with me again. Stand up where you are. I'm assuming you have enough room to swivel your body from your hips. Turn around. To your right or to your left, it matters not. And go as far around you as you can with your arm extended and your finger pointing. When you've gone as far around as you can go, sit down your arm and make a note of something which your finger is pointing at as a marker. Now come back around to the front. Take a deep breath, close your eyes after you finish reading this. And in your mind's eye, without moving your body, imagine yourself turning around again the same way you did before. Only this time you go far, far beyond where you've gone before. Now you see yourself coming back to the front. Open your eyes. Take another deep breath. Now, when you feel like it, turn around again and see how far you can go. Your results prove the value of the trance state. And if that doesn't do it, read Inner Tennis and Inner Skiing and anything about the Feldenkrais technique. I learned about the power of creative visualization in Anthony Robbins' NLP class and had it reinforced when I interviewed a skyscraper climber, 22-year-old Dan Goodwin, who climbed the 102-story John Hancock building in Chicago. Goodwin told me that he can sat down beneath the building a few days before he climbed it, visualizing every inch of the climb. When I plan the climb long before, whenever I visualize the building in my mind's eye, I say water coming down to it. I saw lots of water coming down, Goodwin said. The day of the climb, Goodwin wore a wetsuit instead of the Spider-Man suit he usually wore. On the 37th floor, he found out why he'd worn the wetsuit when an ex shattered the window near him. An overzealous fireman tried to knock him off the building by spraying him with a powerful jet of water from a fire hose above him. They were trying to kill me, Goodwin said. The Chicago Fire Department wanted to knock me off the building. As if a torch had been lit beneath me, I bursted it all into a determined energy, climbing at a rate that would surely have broken the speed records, Goodwin said. The higher I rose, the stronger the water pressure grew. The frequency of the broken glass and the flying axes increased. In the end, Goodwin negotiated a settlement with the city of Chicago. Charges were dropped in exchange for some autographed photos of the mayor shaking hands with Goodwin. I don't think I'd have a wet suit have made it if I wasn't wearing that. And I would have been wearing the wetsuit unless I'd seen myself climbing that building soaking wet, he nervously said. Such is the power of the human unconscious and the usefulness of visualizations. Here are a couple of exercises that will improve that. Number one, people are accessible to you. Number two, you can too be a hypnotist and use that language of the unconscious to get what you want, no matter what it is. Tony Robbins told me this one, and you might want to adapt it to your own situation. Tony went to lunch with a couple of men he wanted to invest in one of his businesses. He was explaining to them that NLP worked and that it was a tool of communication that would eventually be included in our culture from kindergarten through family upbringing, military training, and so on. At some point, he realized that no amount of logical explanation would get these guys to understand and believe in what he was trying to tell them. But his companion's attention had been captured by an attractive brunette who entered the restaurant. Following her lunch date, the woman walked past her table to be seated against the opposite wall of the dining room. She sat facing away from Tony, but still was within view, and behind his two prospective investors. After Tony realized it would take too much time to educate his prospective investors, he remembered the language of the unconscious and decided to apply it to achieve his outcome. "See that attractive brunette over there?" he said, gesturing toward the woman. Both men turned around and looked at her. If without saying a word to her or leaving my chair, Tony said, I get her to come over here and introduce herself to me. Will you invest in my business? Both men agreed that it would be impossible for him to do that, but reluctantly they agreed they would invest if in fact he could make that happen. So Tony went to work. He matched the woman's physiology, sat the way she was sitting, gestured the way she was gesturing, and most importantly, he matched her breathing pattern. He could do this easily because she was in line of sight. The two prospective investors couldn't see the woman and didn't know what Tony was doing. At one point, when Tony had established a perfect match of the brunette's physiology and breathing, she did as most people do, unconsciously or otherwise. She felt something that made her turn around and look at Tony, whereupon he gave a wave of his hand and familiar gesture that says, come on over. All this time, Tony was making small talk with the two prospective investors and enjoying his lunch. They did not notice anything unusual about his behavior. He kept talking about NLP, his business idea, and their investing in the company. When the brunette's date got up to pay the check, and she was following him out of the restaurant, she passed Robin's table, stopped, and said to him, My name is Sue Smith. Don't I know you? Tony and Sue had an instant rapport. They exchanged phone numbers, Tony was single at the time, and the two invested in his company. Vary this story any way you want, but try it yourself. And if you don't understand what I've written here, since it's easier to see and try it than to talk about it, take Tony's class or my class in any NLP class and you'll learn how to mirror and match. Or perhaps you prefer to prove the power of your ability to communicate with others through the language of the unconscious this way. How to get a table in a crowded restaurant without having to wait, without bribery. Approach the person in charge of the waiting list. Notice some attractive visual to which the keeper is insensitive, something he or she has been looking at for days or weeks and it doesn't notice anymore, something which, when it was new, he or she liked to look at. Maybe a grouping of artificial flowers, a new wallpaper, a tablecloth, the cover of a menu. Say, my, that's a good-looking whatever it may be. Follow this by noticing some sound, like the high-pitched whine of the bearing going out on the ventilation system. Say, you know that bearing sounds like it needs oil. And then immediately take notice of an aroma. Say, ribs being barbecued over a mesquite grill. The list taker smells it night after night and so has become consciously desensitized to it. As he or she has become desensitized to the sound of the bearing and the sight of the tablecloth, the unconscious is alert, even say when the conscious mind is asleep. Say, that barbecue sure smells good. Follow these validations. Feedback to the sensory awareness of a sight or sound and a smell of unconscious input with a positivity word suggested. And since I have to get back to the hospital as there are patients depending upon me, you will put my name at the end of your list and call out and insert your name. Then follow up with a totally irrelevant question such as, did it rain here last night? The list keeper's subconscious reacts this way. Yeah, the tablecloth is pretty. He was right about that. I was aware of all that time. And yeah, I did hear that squeaking bearing and know it needed oil. And he's right again. I do think the ribs smell delicious on the barbecue. This guy's right about all three of these sensory inputs of mine. So he must be right about what he tells me that I'll put his name at the head of the list. But he or she doesn't remember thinking that. He or she doesn't remember you're saying anything because he or she is trying to remember if it rained last night. In effect, he or she has amnesia to the embedded command. You will put my name at the head of the list and call out blank your name. The unconscious mind is like a big, dumb machine. It goes where you direct it. It goes to once you get to where you're going, it keeps going off in the direction you've pointed it. Then you've walked away from the list keeper. A moment goes by until the list keeper sees an open table which can accommodate your party, and even though it's against the boss's orders to put anybody at the head of the list keeper finds herself or himself calling you my name, not knowing why or she unconsciously did it. These are simple and safe forms of hypnosis you can try just for fun. They should prove to you, beyond a doubt, that there's untapped power in learning the language of the unconscious. The CIA has a school for training its agents in these techniques and communications, and so does the DIA. It's time everybody learn the language of the unconscious. What follows are categories of behavior that occur in trance. Dissociation, known in waking states as reverie or daydreaming. Catalepsy, a state characterized by uncommon muscular rigidity. Amnesia, a common phenomenon in everyday life, like the times when you've had a word on the tip of your tongue but can't remember it. Anesthesia, related to amnesia, the subject dissociates from feelings and parts of the body. Age regression, reliving or reviving the past in a present context, is yet another form of dissociation. Negative and positive hallucinations. Negative hallucinations refers to a trance subject's ability to delete sensory information at the hypnotist's suggestion. Positive hallucination is the experience of stimuli that are not present. Ideomotor activity. This refers to the involuntary capacity of the muscles and nervous system to respond to external stimuli. This is useful in enhancing suggestibility. Hyperamnesia or memory recall. In deep trance, people can recall events from their past in much greater detail than while in a normal waking state. Time distortion or pseudo-orientation in time. A person absorbed in a good concert will experience the passage of time much differently from someone taking a difficult test. Post-hypnotic suggestion and post-hypnotic design. A special kind of pseudo-orientation in time, programming a subject to respond to some future stimulus in a given way. According to U.S. Army PsyOps Colonel John Alexander, in 1983, the Jedi Master from George Lucas's Star Wars provided an image and a name for the Jedi Project, a human performance modeling experiment based on neurolinguistic programming skills. Sponsored by a U.S. government interagency task force, Jedi used advanced influence technologies to model excellence in human performance. The subjects involved in Jedi were willing to be influenced to acquire desirable skills. The Jedi program project grew out of the new patterns of influence program developed during the early 80s to disseminate NLP skills throughout the U.S. Army, under the auspices of the U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command, and until 1984, the Organizational Effectiveness School. Colonel Alexander told us, under the auspices of Major General Stubblebine, a small interagency team with the U.S. Army as the lead member was formed to see if NLP modeling technology could be beneficially applied to real-world training problems. Since the U.S. military is the largest training institution in the world, much time and money could be saved by improving techniques for teaching common skills. This team was part of a social, large-scale organizational look at training technologies. As team members become familiar with NLP capabilities, they started wondering where its boundaries might be. They came to the conclusion that much boundaries existed only in the minds and belief systems of individuals. New and more complex skill would be required of our warriors in the future, and the project was an attempt to adapt training skills to meet the future needs, Alexander wrote. I had less luck when I was seated next to General Krulak, commander of the 29 Palms Marine Base, at a Bob Hope Classic bouquet in Palm Springs. I tried to convince the general to get the entire U.S. Marine Corps to walk on fire so that they would have a winning resource state to use when they had to go into combat. Alexander named Wyatt Woodesmall as one of the Army's NLP instructors, and since I too received instruction from Woodsmall, I can attest to his competency, efficiency, and integrity, as I can do that of Anthony Robbins, whom Alexander did not name, but who told us about his involvement in Jedi. Their politics, of course, might be a different thing to attest to. Quoting Krulak's repeal of the National Security Act speech. Alexander makes several mistakes in his book, The Warrior's Age. If I had made such mistakes in the first edition of this book, I would never have heard the end of it. He demonstrated a philosophical incongruence applying to the highest ideas of the lowest purposes, the art of war. He also omitted from his name and his book some of the most important premises of NLP, premises without which doesn't really work at all. He unforgivably misidentified the great hypnotist and psychiatrist Milton Erickson as Eric Erickson, and so on. To say the least, the book is fragmentary, incomplete, and error-ridden. Still, let's give Alexander and his collaborators, Janet Morris, co-promoter of non-lethal weaponry, and Major Richard Groler, USAR, high scores from Jeffersonian effort in making the attempt to enlighten the military-industrial complex through education. One of the Army's students, former intelligence officer Julianne McKinney, experiencing the Army's NLP training, quote, said, "It was a superficial thing," she said. "Like most of the military education, one got it, was geared to the lowest learners, and you usually don't get people that swift in the military, even in the intelligence branches. Military training is a second-rate education at best. I can't use a bit of NLP today." Of course, McKinney was trained by the people who trained the people who trained the people. Things do have a tendency to get watered down. The military, as well as major corporations, have been very interested in putting NLP to use. The Ford Motor Company, Westinghouse, and the Calvin Klein Fashion House are among the scores of major companies that have sent employees for training. According to the New York Times, Kevin Garby, an author and researcher at New Age Topics in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, cites his Army recruiting slogan, "Be All You Can Be," as evidence of what he contends has been the significant influence of NLP. In the early 1980s, Garby said, "Officers at the Army War College in Carlisle, some of whom were graduates of EST and were former members of the Radical Students for a Democratic Society, conducted a study aimed at creating a new age army. The slogan, a derivative of the 'you create your own reality' orthodoxy of new age groups, grew out of this work. The study," the Times reported, "according to participants, also envisaged training soldiers in meditation, developing skills in extrasensory perception, magic, and in neurolinguistic training, a hypnosis technique." A number of former students of NLP founder Richard Bandler remember him boasting in class that he could commit murder and use NLP to convince a jury that he was innocent. Some think that's what he may have done in 1987 when he tried for murder and was acquitted. A lengthy article in San Jose Mercury News began with a quote from Brandler. "I'm going to play some mind games with you in this seminar because the brain is my favorite toy." He seemed to be at the peak of his form that day, although later people would start to wonder. The room was full of psychotherapists all laughing at his jokes. It was 1983, 4 years before the murder. Richard Bandler was talking about motivation and how people's attitudes could be changed through therapy. This went to the heart of neurolinguistic programming, the controversial discipline he co-founded 10 years before. NLP, a mixture of hypnosis and linguistics, studied how people influence each other in subconscious ways. The idea was that covert manipulation could be learned and applied with beneficial results. Psychotherapists had called it a dangerous form of mind control, but they couldn't get the seminars fast enough. Neither could doctors, lawyers, corporate executives, salespeople, anyone who thought a little manipulation could go a long way. So on this day in 1983, about 15 therapists were sitting in their rented chairs, and Bandler was observed that many attitudes are thought to be hard to change. Most of us, for example, avoid doing certain tasks because we associate them with anxiety and discomfort, and we can't imagine feeling any other way. He asked for personal examples from the group. A male therapist offered me, "What would make you do this behavior willingly?" Bandler asked. "Absolutely nothing," the man said. Was he sure? The man looked sure. Well, a small caliber handgun might do the job, he offered flippantly. Bandler reached into his pocket and whipped out a Derringer. Would this do? Question mark. He waved the gun in the man's face. Do you want to change now? When he saw the gun, the therapist went into deep panic. The incident was so embarrassing that even now, 4 years later, he agrees to discuss it only on the condition of anonymity. So we'll call him Dave. When I saw the gun, Dave says, I knew he wasn't going to use it, but I did not know for sure that absolutely he wouldn't. Bandler stared at him. You don't look like I'm going to use this, do you? He said. He jacked up the gun and walked closer. Are you sure I won't use it? Then he walked away. Bandler kept this up for perhaps 10 minutes, walking back and forth. Every time he walked away, Dave would intellectualize and disassociate. Every time Bandler came closer, Dave almost crapped in my pants and ran out the room. Dave swung back and forth between the two states of mind, helplessly under Bandler's spell. Others in the room were terrified. There was no one taking a breath, said one observer. When it was over, Dave says, he vowed never to use such a technique on his own patients. It was far too aggressive. But a few months later, his attitude toward that task he'd mentioned to Bandler underwent a dramatic and positive shift. To this day, NLP trainers call the incident one of Bandler's most delicate and brilliant pieces of work. What was so funny, Dave says, is that I made the suggestion myself. I gave him the ammunition. I guess there was a part of me that said, it's time to work on this, but I never in God's world expected him to have a gun in his pocket. The article goes on with Bandler's history, telling how he cured people from addictions to alcohol, cigarettes, food, drugs, and other cravings you could possibly imagine. But if Bandler ever tried them on himself, he never mentioned it. He found new thrills elsewhere. He started working with the U.S. Army and the Central Intelligence Agency, doing projects on post-Vietnam stress syndrome, marksmanship, removing foreign assets from speech. He did some highly sensitive work for the CIA on training potential hostages to withstand torture and interrogation. Kate Wells, a local attorney, remembering sitting in his apartment one day with the treetop of CIA agents in the country. They were like this with Richard. She makes a googling face. They were in awe of him. They wouldn't have done anything to please him. Sitting in this cruddy little criminal room in Capitol, it was surreal. What, then, do you think of the cryptocracy had to do with the framing Richard Bandler for murder, and why? All we know is that on November 3rd, 1986, Richard Bandler was charged with killing a woman with a single shot to the head. The victim was Corrine Christensen, 31, an alleged prostitute and cocaine dealer. She died in her townhouse in Santa Cruz, a block from Bandler's. Bandler declared his innocence, hired a lawyer, went to court, and was acquitted of the crime. A friend of Bandler's named James Marino, alleged to be a cocaine dealer who was in the room at the time of the shooting, failed to appear in court. He said he feared for his own safety. After lengthy discussion with his attorney, Marino was persuaded to surrender. Marino was one of the only witnesses against Bandler. He gave a lengthy, rambling testimony which described how Bandler had shot Christensen through the face with a .357 Magnum, which he had just found in the waters off of Capitola Pier, just where Marino said he would be. When the hearing was over, Municipal Court Judge Tom Kelly spoke frankly. My mind went back and forth all week, he said, about which man was guilty. He would order the case to trial, he said, but his evidence so far seemed skimpy. The only thing I know for sure, beyond a reasonable doubt, is we had a murderer in this courtroom, but last week, for a half. The judge declared, beyond a reasonable doubt, I cannot tell you who that person was. A caption under a photo in the report reads, Bandler and UC Santa Cruz linguistic professor John Grinder divided people into three broad categories depending on the sensory mode they preferred. Some people are predominantly visual, some auditory, others were kinesthetic. NLP was soon being sold as an aid to therapy, business, sales, even law, where it was pronounced as boom to trial work. When critics attacked it, a as a form of dark magic. Bandler and Grinder retorted that people have been manipulating each other for centuries, and they might as well understand what's going on. The only thing the reader needs to know about this case, for the purposes of our report, is Richard Bandler was tried for murder and found not guilty by jury of his peers. The tinge of guns and drugs and the Jedi fantasies of the cryptocracy surround NLP like a foul-smelling smog. Its name has been so tainted that Anthony Robbins no longer calls it by the name, nor other masters of Ericksonian art. Another U.S. Army PSYOPs, Colonel Michael Aquino, had an equal, if opposite, fascination with Lucas' Star Wars trilogy. Aquino's affinity was for the dark side of the Force. The Jedi gone wrong. Darth Vader. In the diaries and notes of the presidential model, Aquino is witnessed wearing his Darth Vader cape to the White House. Much to Aquino's dismay and embarrassment, Reagan admired the occult role that this Army Lieutenant Colonel played for mind control traumatization purposes, as it fit with the public promotion of religion Reagan had launched. Reagan claimed to believe that the masses were easiest to manipulate through the religion, as were mind controlled slaves like myself. While Reagan had Aquino in D.C., he demanded that he wear his black ritual robes to a White House party to reinforce the controlling superstitions of a few South Central American diplomats. Aquino appeared foolish in the eyes of his peers. They knew Aquino's image was the only guise for psychological warfare, but his appearance at the White House and costume made Aquino look like he believed his own facade. We've already heard a lot about Colonel Aquino, but now let's see if we can find out anything about his personal philosophy. What did this U.S. Army intelligence colonel do for relaxation? He wrote fiction. Specifically, he used George Lucas's Star Wars to explicate his dark philosophy. In Darth Vader Fantasy, The Secret of the Sith, published in Famous Monsters magazine, Aquino's Darth asks Aquino's Princess Leia, "Who are you to pursue selfish policies of regional prosperity and callous disregard for the damage they may cause throughout the rest of the galaxy?" A little while later, Darth says, "It would be far more efficient than the Senate, but neither my attention span nor my reasoning process are optimum for the task, nor is any other organic mind capable of such performance, particularly over an extended period of time on a continuous basis. No, the only solution is to place impersonal sovereignty in the hands of a positronic computer." Sound like Delgado's civilization? At lower levels, there will be increasing latitude for aesthetic opinions, of course, and planetary governments can squabble to their heart's content. But no individual or group of individuals should have the power to make or not make decisions completely beyond their competence. Aquino's Princess Leia tells Aquino's Darth Vader, "I find it hard to believe that you have the best interest at heart. You are too far removed from them. Darth Vader, you know they are little more than a cosmic gaming pieces which you manipulate not out of affection for them, but out of curiosity to see what you can do with them. Perhaps you are content in such a godlike posture. I would not be." Aquino's Han Solo says, "What point is there to civilization, as you call it, if no one can move on impulse without causing chain reactions of these dire consequences that you speak of?" And Darth responds, "As for the constriction of the free will, I, of all individuals, am opposed to that. I have spent my lifetime strengthening my own will in an absolute sense, not just as opposed to others. As far as impulsive decisions, they were tolerable when they affected only a few words at a time. You'd find it difficult to argue that they were beneficial even then. The price we pay for commerce and communications across an entire galaxy is the loss of impulse in favor of reason. Bear in mind that the benefits are reciprocal. The decision you make may mean happiness and prosperity for worlds beyond, far beyond yours, and their decisions may have a corresponding effect upon your home. If you can exist in an environment free from unnecessary misery, you will have the freedom to exercise your will in ways that are truly creative. That is what I would prefer." Later in Aquino's story, Darth is apparently killed. Amidst the wreckage, Darth Vader staggered to his feet, then stiffened in shock as a laser bolt from Leia's organic blaster struck him full in the back. The force of its impact tore the mask from his head and the protective plates from the chest, and Leia and Solo saw what a thrill of horror that the humanoid features beneath were hideously decomposed and disfigured. Exposed to the air, they began to devolve, and gradually Darth Vader's entire body boiled away into nothingness. One notes, quote, a thrill of horror, and the body disappearing when exposed into the air. A metaphor for the cryptocracy, perhaps. Here's a chunk of O's journal I did not previously include. It might shed some light on the PSYOP's hypnotic techniques and the official government operations with hypno-programmed Americans. Death's door programming, though simplistic in its application, is as complex as the mind of a multiple personality disordered, mind-controlled slave. As a mind-controlled slave, I have no conscious awareness of my personality being switched, either from within or through the deliberate triggering of others. Since I had no ability to logically reason, I had no actual appreciation of time whereby I could not think to notice time had passed unaccounted for. While in another personality, I existed only in the moment, doing exactly what I was told. Switching personalities was so absolute that the experiences of a particular personality resulted in particular perceptions. Ocular eye pressure changed visual acuity fields, whereby depth perception changed. Senses and sensation changed according to exactly which part of the brain was being accessed to function. Disassociation equated to removing myself psychologically from my experience, whereby I disassociated from my body and the tortures it was enduring. Prior conditioning necessary for survival had taught me to retreat so deep into my mind that sensations of torture seemed to be far away, as though it were through a long, dark tunnel, compared to a personality whose non-threatened down-to-earth daily routine required no such survival skills. The perceptual shift becomes more clearly understood. Therefore, switching personalities actually felt, in retrospect, like a dimensional shift, which is the perceptual, psychological target of death's doors programmers. The CIA has numerous near-death trauma centers for creating seemingly indestructible human slaves, much the same way the military creates Delta Force soldiers. Mind-controlled slaves, such as myself, were programmed at such installations since the same high-technology equipment and methods were acquired by attaching certain programming to natural MPD survival phenomena. The skills could be enhanced. Slow blood flowing through deep dissociative trance increased chances of survival. Pain could be perceived as pleasure, which furthered the benefits of dissociative mind-over-matter trance. Accelerated tissue healing could be hypnotically induced and further enhanced by switching my personalities, whereby I no longer was aware of the tortures the other's personalities endured. As a programmed mind-controlled slave, I was led to believe that the shifting of personalities was a shifting of dimensions to escape the pain. U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel then Michael Aquino of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency's Psych Warfare Section instilled Death's Door programming on me at a mind control research facility located at Presidio Army Base in San Francisco, California. While I was being prepared for programming, I overheard Aquino talking with an understanding pertaining to Death's Door. Aquino's personal belief system and theories were included in the discussion. He claimed to believe that death in itself a changing of dimensions, whereby our near-death experience would open doors to even more dimensions. Aquino told his associate that I had been so close to death on numerous occasions that a wide path had been worn in my mind towards the end. Therefore, he explained, she had increased her ability to enter other dimensions en route to death. These dimensions Aquino used as a means of hypnotically scrambling and compartmentalizing my memories of key events, government secrets, and identities. Anchored in the natural timelessness of multiple personality disorder, I had been reportedly conditioned to the idea of timeless interdimensional travel. Aquino claimed to believe that time existed only in the mind of man and could therefore be manipulated as easily as the mind. He told his colleague, Whether in principle or in theory, the results are the same since the concept of time in itself is abstract. This program, anchored in timelessness, further reinforced my inability to comprehend that time had indeed passed and events occurred. My scrambling memory of interdimensional experiences would have remained unrecoverable had I not been deprogrammed to realize that my memories were experienced and photographically recorded right here in this dimension. My memory was simply compartmentalized in my own brain. Therefore, logically, it was accessible. At the Presidio Mind Control Research Facility, I was placed in a sensory deprivation chamber. Aquino programmed me with what I suspect were harmonics through the chamber's embedded sound system. This produced a physical sensation of floating weightlessly through space while the sound seemed to be heard from within my head rather than my ears. Aquino's suggestion that I was in crematorium was readily accepted, and I could feel the flames intensifying as my brain perceived the event virtually as reality. Aquino played the role of my savior by leading me safely and painlessly through death's door. I had no alternative but to follow his programming commands and later carry out the ensuing orders he would embed deep within my autogenetic primitive mind. He hypnotically induced the sensation of my burning alive through the affecting of my histamine production, then shifted dimensions in my mind in preparation for the orders I would carry out as though my life depended upon it. Aquino slowly and hypnotically led me. You have deep within you the ability to slip through death's door, an ability encoded in you since the inception of time. Since your inception and birth into this world of time, this physical world of matter, the only world where time matters. Only a visitor in this dimension, you have harnessed your ability to come and go as you please once you access the door encoded in your mind. Follow me now while I lead you on a journey through your mind right to the door that will set you free. I must break the description of the death's door hypnotic process off at its beginning. This is a particularly dangerous process which could be harmful to those who have been similarly programmed or adapted by experimenters to their own uses with destructive results. Suffice it to say, this hypnotic metaphor fits well into Aquino's fiction, The Secret of the Sith. One grows curious about the connection between Aquino and Alexander, two U.S. Army PSYOP colonels who said they don't talk to each other but have both taken the Star Wars metaphors as their own. Neither answered my requests for an interview.